I'm Charlie Stokes. I'm President and CEO of the CDC Foundation. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the 2011 Gerald Lynn Hilleman Endowed Lecture. The CDC Foundation was created in 1995 by Congress to help CDC do more than it could normally do as a government agency, faster than it could do it, working within the constraints that every government agency has to work within, with the whole purpose of making the world a safer and healthier place. As an independent nonprofit organization, the CDC Foundation works to unite a wide range of partners, from corporate to nonprofit to individuals, with CDC scientists to achieve common goals. It's our pleasure to again host this Gerald Lynn Hilleman Endowed Lectureship this year, which exemplifies the kind of collaborative objective that the CDC Foundation was created to be engaged in. This particular lectureship was established in 1995 by the Merck Company Foundation. It was established through the CDC Foundation to honor both CDC's 50th anniversary and the 25th anniversary of the first combination vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. The lectureship was named for the daughter of Maurice Hilleman, who is often credited with saving more lives than any other scientist in the past century. Dr. Hilleman is widely regarded as the world's foremost vaccine developer. This makes the CDC's annual National Immunization Conference really the ideal place to showcase heroes in the field through this lectureship. And so we're delighted to be hosting you this evening. We say welcome. And it's now my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Mark Feinberg, who's Vice President of Medical Affairs and Policy for Merck Vaccines and Infectious Diseases Division. Please help me give a warm welcome to Dr. Mark Feinberg.
One of the best parts of my job is getting to introduce the Hilleman Lecturer every year. Each year we have really tremendous speakers who share, I think, very important insights with us and really fine demonstrations of careers in public health that have really made a difference around the world. But this year, I'm very happy to say that we will be having Dr. Bill Foege speaking, and Dr. Foege was actually the first Hilleman lecturer 15 years ago, and of all the Hilleman lecturers and their exceptional contributions, I think he holds a special place among that very illustrious group. And so it's a distinct pleasure of mine to be able to participate in facilitating this introduction with my colleague, Dr. Ann Schuchat. For many of you who know Dr. Foege, I don't really need to give him an introduction, but I do want to comment for maybe some of those of you who don't. He's truly a legend in public health, a leader of exceptional vision and commitment, and someone who's also, as you'll see, a captivating speaker. He's an extraordinarily insightful individual and someone who simply cannot take no for an answer when he sees suffering around the world and an opportunity to make a difference. And by doing so, I think he's clearly been an inspiration for many people in this room and many people around the world, myself included. Describing his own influences in the early stages of his career, Dr. Foege cited a talk given by Dr. Thomas Weller at the Harvard Medical School commencement in 1963. Dr. Weller was someone who Dr. Foege subsequently worked with and was a mentor of his. And in that prescient talk, Dr. Weller stated that it appears that the physician interested in alleviation of human misery will in the future be increasingly concerned with new environmental health problems arising from an industrialized society and with the control of pandemics of infectious agents that have found within the changing human ecological pattern conditions optimal for their rapid dissemination. This was in 1963, remarkably enough. Dr. Weller went on, the logical approach to a solution to these problems of the present and the future will be at the community level and will deal with what Warren Weaver has termed organized complexity. It is my view that this area of medical endeavors, Dr. Weller continued, is deserving of highest priority in any consideration of how you may best pursue your medical career. In continuing a discussion of the moral implications of the quest for new knowledge in medicine, Weller cited Hensch, who described the fundamental purpose of discovery in medicine as being the end of it is not the new or stimulating truth, but the serviceable application of the truth. To be useful, medical truth must be put to work. It must serve, and I think that's a real testament to that belief, and I think Dr. Fahey has exemplified that in a remarkable way in his career, clearly demonstrating how you can put knowledge to work and applying discoveries to serve. One of the great examples of this that we, my Merck colleagues and I know, is the key role that Dr. Fahey played in the planning and development and implementation of the Mectazan donation program. In the 1980s, Merck scientists had shown that the drug ivermectin or Mectazan was effective at treating onchocerciasis, which was then a leading cause of blindness in the developing world. But even with the commitment of the company to give the drug away for free because there was no commercial market for it, there was no path forward because no one would take Merck up on the offer until Dr. Fahey stepped in and defined a path, the creation of the Mectazan Expert Committee and really launching the Mectazan donation program. To date, that program has been remarkably successful, and I had to actually correct or check these figures with one of my colleagues in Merck today. It has turned out that over 3.5 billion tablets of Mectazan have been delivered since 1987, and over 100 million treatments have been delivered in the year 2010 alone. The reason why that program has been so successful is because it got off to a great start, and it wouldn't have gotten off to a great start without Dr. Fahey. One of my colleagues who works in that program, I asked her about her thoughts about Dr. Fahey, and what she wrote to me is, the one characteristic I always think about when I hear Bill's name is his insistence on getting people to think big and bold. He always emphasized the importance of setting lofty, far-reaching goals and going for it rather than letting risk or feel a failure get in the way of aiming high. I think that's remarkably true. And in fact, you know, Dr. Fahey, in a receipt of an award in recognition of Albert Sabin, quoted Kurt Vonnegut as saying that geniuses are people who plagiarize from the future. And in describing Sabin, Dr. Fahey described him as saying he saw a future that others didn't see and then made it possible by actually changing the future to his specifications. I can't think of a better example of Dr. Fahey than that statement as well, and it's a true pleasure to have him here today, and it's always a pleasure to have be followed by Dr. Schuchat, who is, I believe, a true public health champion as well, who's the director, as you know, of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases.
Well, good evening, and let me join Mark and Charlie in welcoming you to this incredible evening. You are all in for a major treat. Dr. Fahey is a world-renowned tall person. His name has become synonymous with hero. He helped rid the world of smallpox, serving as chief of the CDC's smallpox eradication program, before becoming director of the Centers for Disease Control in 1977, before it was the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He next formed and led the Task Force for Child Survival, and most recently helped advise Bill and Melinda Gates on really lasting ways to spend their foundation's money. As you probably know, their highest priority is vaccines, speaking to the excellent advice that they received. While for many, Dr. Fahey's legacy is forever tied up with disease eradication, he also has championed numerous other public health endeavors: injury prevention, consequential epidemiology, child survival, and health equity before anybody started calling it that. Since I couldn't really do his history or personal character justice, and since I started the morning off with a nod to Paul McCartney, I thought I would introduce our speaker with apologies to John Lennon. Imagine there's no smallpox. It's easy if you try. No polio or measles. Don't have to tell you why. Imagine all the people asking for vaccines. Oh, whoa, whoa. They've, They may say he's a dreamer, but he's not the only one. We all share in his vision of the world when there'll be none. So with that, I would like to introduce this year's Hilleman Lecturer, Dr. Bill Fagin.
Thank you. First, thank you, Anne, both for the introduction, but for the magnificent talk you gave this morning. It was, it really set things on the right track. And Mark, thank you for your nice words. I can never quite get over the fact that Merck decided to develop this drug even when they knew it could not make a profit. Roy Vagelos at that time was head of research. Mohammed Aziz came and asked him for money to go to Africa and see whether the drug would work on onchocerciasis. They figured out ahead of time that they could not make a profit on it, and despite that, Roy Vagelos gave them the money to do this. And so we have to see that corporations can be altruistic also, because the people in the corporations are often altruistic. Years ago, NPR did an interview with a couple about to celebrate their 80th wedding anniversary. They were both 100 years old. And the interviewer asked them, what does it feel like to be 100 years old? And expecting the wisdom of the ages, or at least 200 years of wisdom, the interviewer was surprised when they said, it kind of snuck up on us. And that's what's happened with immunization. We're at this high point with immunization, and it kind of snuck up on us. It's true that time goes fast, but you will never understand this until you're old. You hear it all the time. As I ponder what has happened in my small and diminishing area of expertise, I end up with the phrase of Will Durant, the maddening stinginess of time. My birth was closer to the Gettysburg Address than to today. I mean, think of that. The last soldier to die from the Civil War era died when I was in medical school. So time goes by so fast, and the point I want to make tonight is that the immunization time is compressed the same way. It has gone by so fast. So I have two objectives: to talk a little bit about the journey that we've traveled in immunization and to look forward and ask what are the rough spots ahead so that we think about them before they sneak up on us. First, the journey. Your immunization journey, while you may not know this, started in 1796. Let's see if I can get the... Edward Jenner lived in this home in 1796, and it's now the Edward Jenner Museum. He was a family practitioner, and... Oops, I'm going the wrong way. And this is his table where he worked, as it was when he died. He went out that night to certify the death of the coroner. He came back to make his notes, and he was sitting at this table when he had a stroke. They carried him up to his bedroom upstairs, and he died several days later. But you can get some feeling for what it must have been like, and this is the table that he worked at, as he began thinking about the question, why did milkmaids have such nice complexions? The poets talked about their nice complexions, and as a scientist, he tried to figure this out. For 12 years, he studied what happened to milkmaids during smallpox outbreaks, and he became convinced that they were protected from smallpox because, as they milked cows, they got lesions on their hands called cowpox that left little scars but protected them from smallpox. He finally decided in 1796 to try this out, and he took, in the spring of 1796, material from the hands of a milkmaid, Sarah Nelms, inoculated it into the arm of James Phipps. And then a few weeks later, he tried to give James Phipps smallpox. Now, those of you who are involved in review committees, but James Phipps did not get smallpox. And if you go to the museum, they actually have a painting of Blossom the Cow that gave the cowpox to Sarah Nelms. They kept telling me that the museum was haunted, and they actually showed a picture where in the back it appears that there is a ghost in the picture. I took this picture of Blossom the Cow, and I immediately saw that there was too much light reflected on it, so I moved a couple steps, took another picture, and there's Sarah Nelms looking through the ages at us. In the back of the house is a temple to Vaccinia, where once a week Edward Jenner would vaccinate all the people who were poor free. And he would continue vaccinating until the line was gone. So this was the beginning of vaccinology. He knew nothing about vaccines or viruses, but he was trying to imitate nature. But it's the beginning of vaccinology, and I think it's the beginning point for modern public health. It's a place worth seeing. The next person in this journey was Louis Pasteur. And Louis Pasteur is the one that suggested that we call all immunizing agents vaccines in order to honor Edward Jenner and his work with Vaccinia. And he suggested that we call all immunizations vaccinations. I went to the memorial service for Jonas Salk, and one of the speakers was Charles Mériou from France. And he talked about the history of vaccination, how it had gone from 18th century England with Edward Jenner to 19th century France with Louis Pasteur to 20th century the United States with Jonas Salk. Years ago, I was in Charles's home in France, and he showed me a picture of his father in the lab. And then he said, "The man standing next to my father is Louis Pasteur." And suddenly it all came together for me that this history of immunization is that short, that I know a man whose father worked with Louis Pasteur, who suggested that we honor Edward Jenner by calling these vaccinations, and that's the entire history of immunization right there in that room. So, these were important people, but I do not think they were as important as the person that we honor tonight. Maurice Hilleman attended the first Maurice Hilleman lecture 15 years ago. He was sitting in the front row. And I said at the time, this man is the Louis Pasteur of our time. And I know now that I underestimated him. He was far greater than Louis Pasteur. And those of you in immunization, when you give measles vaccine, mumps vaccine, rubella vaccine, varicella vaccine, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, meningitis, pneumococcal vaccine, H-flu vaccine, think of Maurice Hilleman. Those vaccines all came out of his mind. Think of this. I mean, there's been no one like him ever in the area of vaccinology. And then when I think of how close he came to not doing that, his twin sister died the day the two of them were born. 2 days later, his mother died. Maurice was raised on a ranch in Montana and almost didn't go to college. As I recall, he got a job in a Sears store, and that's what he intended to do. Someone kept after him to go to college, and he finally did. And then he applied at 6 graduate schools, was admitted to all 6 of them with a full scholarship, and went to the University of Chicago. Your job would be far less complicated if he had never gone to college. Now, in biology, we memorize a phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And I say we memorized it because I can tell you we didn't know what it meant. And what it means is that the development of an individual relives the entire history of individuals in the lineage of that person or that animal or that plant. And likewise, when you give a vaccine to a child, that vaccine relives the entire developmental process of that vaccine. So when you give a vaccine to a child, every child not only incorporates their total lineage, but the total lineage of this vaccine, which means that in the germinal center of a child, when they get a vaccine, it now includes the entire history of Jenner, Pasteur, Hilleman, and you. Now, isn't that quite a thought? But you're still working in the adolescence of immunization. It's not reached full maturity. And you're molding what this program will look like in the future. We already give 2 vaccines for cancer. We're going to be giving more vaccines, anti-cancer vaccines in the future. We will be giving vaccines against heart disease and stroke. We will be giving vaccines that reduce the chance of addiction to drugs, reduce the chance of addiction to tobacco. It's not simply the people that we honor in all of this. You have to know some of the events. I was in college when one of these milestone events occurred. Jonas Salk had developed a vaccine for polio. Jonas was so determined that this vaccine was good that it didn't even require field testing. He said, if we field test it and have a placebo group, it means that we will have a group of children who are not getting the benefit of this vaccine. But his mentor, Tommy Francis, said, that's not the way science works. And so Tommy Francis agreed to conduct the field trial. This was a field trial of 1.8 million children. Biggest field trial up till that time or since that time. All without computers. 1.8 million children, 14 months. And then on April 12th, 1955, Tommy Francis was ready to announce the results at an auditorium at the University of Michigan. And just to put you in the time frame, this was a month after Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin, died, a week before Einstein died. And he gets up to the lectern. Now, when we hear the words duty, honor, country, we all think of Douglas MacArthur and his speech at West Point. When I hear the words safe, effective, potent, I think of Tommy Francis that day at the University of Michigan. I stood at that lectern in that auditorium 50 years to the hour after he made that announcement. When he made the announcement, Edward R. Murrow and Fred Friendly and all of these important journalists ran for the door. People didn't have cell phones. They were all running for the payphone to announce that this vaccine worked. And the next day, spontaneously in windows, there were signs that said, "Thank you, Dr. Salk." So a virus pulled this country together. Now, interestingly, the secretary of HHS, H-E-W at that time, was Mrs. Hobby from Texas. She came to Washington and she declared she was going to put an end to any talk of socialized medicine. As soon as this announcement was made, people started clamoring for vaccine, and they were surprised that there was no government plan to provide vaccine. And so the president said, we've got to do something right away. And Mrs. Hobby made an announcement. She would seek an appropriation to buy polio vaccine for poor children. A senator then held a press conference, and he said, no American child will have to declare himself or herself poor to get vaccine, and I will seek an appropriation for polio vaccine for all children. This was the beginning of seeing vaccines not only protecting people, but having a social good. This was the beginning of the government being willing to fund that, and 3 months later, the Senate actually passed a bill to provide for polio vaccine for children in this country. So smallpox then took this from domestic to international, the social good part of this, and for the first time with smallpox, we were able to reach the point where everyone benefited from a vaccine. Everyone now living, everyone in the future. And if we are smart, we will never have to repeat that. And that's one of the nice things about vaccines. You will be back here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and find out what are some of the financial benefits of vaccines. But one of the real benefits is doing things only once in history. You only had to develop smallpox vaccine once in history. You only had to eradicate it once in history. And it's almost as if, instead of borrowing from the future, we're actually giving something to the future that we're paying for our children and our grandchildren. Then in this country, the Carter administration rejuvenated the immunization program, and we began to wonder, could we actually interrupt measles transmission? And just a few years before that, no one would have even thought of that as an objective. In May, the World Health Organization will now debate whether we should, in fact, eliminate measles from the entire world. Because it was done in this country, it was demonstrated that it could happen. So you're all part of a grand history, part of a crusade for social justice in health. But what are some of the speed bumps that we should anticipate ahead of us? And before I get to that, I'm going to use a prop that I've never used. My mother, over 75 years ago, got this book on how to raise a child. And so now I know what went wrong. But the reason I bring it up is, under immunizations, there are only two vaccines listed: diphtheria toxoid and smallpox vaccine. Now, isn't that something? When I became interested in medicine, there were a half dozen vaccines being used. And as you heard from Anne this morning, we're now up to about a dozen and a half. And this is the way it's going to be in the future. So what are the challenges? One is the need for continuous quality improvement. The problem of how do we improve what we do? Improve coverage, simplify schedules, combine vaccines, get rid of needles, improve potency, reduce the need for boosters, remove side effects. Why? Because if it's complicated to give 17 vaccines, what will it be like when we have 24? And what will it be like when we have 36? We have to be thinking ahead. How do we simplify this? There's a continuous need to define the problems clearly and then to define for everyone how to attack those problems. We didn't know how to eradicate smallpox when we started, but we could not have done it if we had not set the objective. And I often say that I grew up with the idea some things have to be seen to be believed, but I learned in smallpox some things have to be believed in order to be seen. Now, part of this is the second big problem that I see us facing is the problem of parents who do not want to have their children immunized. And part of this is due to parents forgetting what the diseases were like. And we have to figure out how to make this very important to them. We heard about pertussis in California today. How do we make this important? Airports do not reduce their budget for fire departments even if they go 20 years without a fire or a crash, or 30 years or 50 years. They understand they have to keep funding that. We have to get that message across. But another problem is misinformation, as you know. I live on an island in Puget Sound. where enough parents have decided not to have their children immunized that the New York Times actually did a front page story on this. Now, these are good parents, and we oftentimes feel a resentment, but these are parents trying to do the right thing for their children, but they have misinformation. You ask them why they won't do this, and the first thing that always comes up is the fear of autism. So how in the world did that happen? We despair that this misinformation could be so widely spread and we've not been able to counteract it. You all know the story, of course. Andrew Wakefield published a paper in Lancet that suggested that MMR vaccine was causing developmental problems. MMR, by the way, was developed by Maurice Hilleman, the first time live agents had been put together in a combination vaccine. If you haven't picked up, I think this man was a genius. But Wakefield made the suggestion that it was causing the developmental problems, and then movie personalities became listened to in this country over pediatricians. And Congressman Dan Burton fueled the flames as he pretended that he was dealing with scientific literacy. Millions of dollars were spent on studies to show there was no increase in autism in children getting MMR or other vaccines. The article was finally retracted. Wakefield lost his license. We now know that he received money from a lawyer who was suing a vaccine company. But he continues to travel this country and talk to parents. Well, parents have enough to worry about without having to worry about something that isn't true. But this is now one of the speed bumps in your future road. Another challenge, the price of success. I've already touched on this, but the more success you have, the more complex all of this will get. The number of vaccines that have to be given at a particular visit and so forth. A fourth challenge, anti-government sentiment. Now, many of you work for government. The anti-government sentiment is pervasive. But I believe much of it is fueled for the wrong reasons. The distrust of politicians is hurting government, and that in turn hurts public health and social welfare. We confuse politicians with government workers. I get this anti-government question so often when I give talks, and I simply ask the person asking the question, can you describe one case of social justice outside of government? Think of that. Government's the only organization that represents all of us. No church group, no social club, no other group represents all of us. Only government. And it's essential that in areas of public health, we have to figure out how to strengthen what the government does rather than vilify it. It's risky to stereotype in either direction. But I can tell you some of my best feelings if I hear about a group that I already stereotype them have to do with the old smallpox workers, Peace Corps volunteers, public health workers. And so we hear all the time, write your congressperson if you want to improve the system. I have a different message for you. Some of you should go into politics. And I'm absolutely serious about that. Because instead of worrying from the outside, let's get voices of reason inside. Another challenge, healthcare reform and the belief in the marketplace. Healthcare reform activities have led to a desire to talk about the marketplace to deliver things. And when you hear a politician get up and say, we have the best health care system in the world, this is not the truth. And you should be careful about what that politician is saying. By almost any measure, we don't get in the top 10 in the world for health care. And part of the reason is because of the fact that it's entered the marketplace. This wasn't true 50 years ago. And when it enters the marketplace, profit becomes the bottom line. And so one has to be very careful. When I listen to politicians, I keep asking myself, well, what's the most ridiculous statement I've heard them make about health care this year? And I don't know, but I'll make stab at it. When Senator John Ensign said, I'm getting so tired of hearing our health care system compared to other countries. He said, if you take away deaths on the highway and deaths from guns, we compare quite favorably with other countries. I mean, it's unbelievable that someone could say that. John Stewart ran that clip and said it's a little bit like saying that except for my infidelities, I'm almost monogamous. The marketplace did not and could not eradicate smallpox or get rid of measles or polio from this country. The marketplace would not save the tobacco problem. The marketplace will not get vaccines to poor kids. And so don't confuse the marketplace and public health. Each has its place. Richard Feynman in 1963 gave a talk at the University of Washington. There are two messages that I take away from that talk. Number one, he said, the Achilles heel of science is certainty. He said, even in physics, where we're more certain than in most things, we spend our lives trying to prove something wrong. And if you've seen the periodic table in the last few months, you now see that the values given to every atom are given with this is the value plus or minus. So even the values of atoms are not certain. But then he goes on to say that certainty is the Achilles heel of politics and religion and almost everything else. But the other thing he said in that lecture, and it builds on what Mark was saying, that the characteristic of science is its application, giving power. And he said the power to do things carries with it no instructions on how to use the power, whether for good or for evil. And then he quotes from a Buddhist temple, to every person is given the key to the gates of heaven. The same key opens the gates of hell. And Feynman then asked, do you throw away the key or do you figure out how to use it? We have the keys to public health power and we have to figure out how to use those keys. So use the best science, but public health is also a work of art. And Einstein said, an educated person is someone who has learned to live life as a work of art. We must practice public health as a work of art and try to connect the science to every person in society. It often requires taking a different perspective. Yogi Berra once faced a brand new pitcher, and the pitcher threw three very bad pitches, and Yogi Berra tried to hit each and missed. Three bad pitches, three strikes, he was out, and he went back to the dugout muttering, how does a pitcher like that stay in this league? So also do we need a different perspective, a perspective that forces us to relook at everything. How can these diseases stay in the league that we are creating? Civilization is a thin veneer, the burden of a small percentage, and public health workers happen to be in that small percent. Civilization is organized kindness, and that's what you're doing every day. Organized kindness. And just as the best picture has not yet been painted, the greatest song unsung, so is the best immunization program in our future. being developed by the people in this room. Do it with ardent science, with creative common sense. Thank Maurice Hilleman as you do it, and accept my thanks on behalf of the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
So get him to sit down, please.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Feige, congratulations for your many years of service, for sharing just a fraction of your expert experience with us tonight. As I mentioned earlier, tonight marks the 15th anniversary of the Hilleman Lectureship, which annually honors an outstanding individual who, through his or her work or leadership, has made significant contributions to the prevention of disease through immunization. Dr. Feige certainly fits that description. And we'd like to honor you, Bill, tonight with a certificate of appreciation for being not only our first but also our 15th lecturer. So thank you so much and congratulations.
And I was told you would keep inviting me back till I get it right.
That's right. And Bill had a great idea. He thinks we should keep inviting him back till he gets it just right. And I think that would be great. Also want to thank the many staff members at CDC and Merck and the CDC Foundation for their work behind the scenes in planning tonight's program, with a special thanks to the members of the Hilleman Lectureship Planning Committee. So finally, we want to invite guests to the reception, honoring the work of Dr. Feige, who will be there. And I want to again thank the Gerald N. Hilleman Endowment for their support for this function, which makes this National Immunization Conference and that Monday evening of the conference so special. The reception now follows, and just want to tell you that if you try to get to the reception by going out those wooden doors in the back, you got to go upstairs and around and down. But if you walk through what they call this air wall over there, there are going to be some openings, I think, down toward the front and toward the back. You'll be able to go right into the room for the reception. So thank you all for being here tonight to listen to and honor Dr. Feige, and enjoy the evening.